Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
The new legislative session gets underway today as Governor Hobbs gives her State of the State address. And one of the first fights could be over taxes.
I am really focused on delivering a tax break to middle-class Arizonans who are struggling right now and who really need that certainty as they go to start filing their taxes.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Also today on the show, Senator Ruben Gallego sees compromise as a tool to bring down health care costs. Would the president's proposal to ban Wall Street investors from buying up housing stock help prices in Phoenix?
And one expert is not surprised by the ICE shooting of a Minneapolis woman and the nationwide protests it sparked.
If you send signals out to people that it's us against the world, then you're going to shift the balance towards the higher risk, more dangerous types of decisions.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says Tehran is asked to set up negotiations over the widespread protests engulfing Iran. He said a meeting could be arranged, but Trump would not rule out U.S. strikes against Iran before that. NPR's Jackie Northam has more.
President Trump said the U.S. might have to act before any meeting with Tehran because of, quote, what's happening in Iran. Thousands of protesters poured into the streets in all corners of the country. Videos of large crowds, burning buildings, and dead bodies in the street and morgues were posted on social media despite an ongoing internet and cell phone blackout. Tehran has not publicly said anything about a meeting with the U.S. Earlier on Sunday, a senior member of Iran's parliament warned that U.S. bases and ships in the region would be legitimate targets for preemptive strikes if it looked as though the U.S. would attack. But Iran's military capabilities were badly weakened during the 12-day war with Israel last June. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Federal Reserve Board Chair Jerome Powell says the Justice Department sent the nation's central bank a subpoena last Friday. It's over the Fed's building renovations of its offices in Washington, D.C. Powell says the Justice Department also threatened a criminal indictment. He released a video statement yesterday saying these are all pretexts to force the Fed to cave to President Trump's views on interest rates.
The threat of criminal charges is a consequence of the Federal Reserve setting interest rates based on our best assessment of what will serve the public, rather than following the preferences of the president. This is about whether the Fed will be able to continue to set interest rates based on evidence and economic conditions, or whether instead monetary policy will be directed by political pressure or intimidation.
Powell says he will continue to do his job as Fed chair. Nurses are walking the picket lines in New York City this morning. Some 15,000 are on strike against several major hospitals that their union says are the most wealthy facilities. NPR's Kristen Wright reports this is one of the largest nursing strikes ever in the city.
Nurses from five hospitals in New York walked off the job. They want to preserve health care benefits, safer staffing, and protections from workplace violence. A man with a sharp object barricaded himself in a hospital room in Brooklyn and was shot and killed by police last week. Darla Joyner is on the picket lines. She's been a nurse for 12 years and is part of the union's bargaining committee.
That's the thing with our job. It can go from 0 to 100. And you can't really say it's just an emergency unit or a psych department. It can happen anywhere in the hospital.
The strike comes during a terrible flu season. Governor Kathy Hochul has declared a disaster emergency due to healthcare staffing shortages. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down more than 100 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. The oldest baby boomers are turning 80 this year, and already there's a push and pull when it comes to how and when this generation wants to age compared to Gen X or millennials. Aaron Guest is an assistant professor of aging at Arizona State University. He says boomers want more age-segregated communities.
Good Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, ICE has been on a hiring spree. Could it be leading to abuse?
And we'll visit an exhibit at Desert Botanical Garden that is part art and part science.
But first, the state legislature gets its new session underway today. Governor Katie Hobbs will give her State of the State address this afternoon. There have been more than 100 bills filed already before the session even started. Many more will follow. And both lawmakers and the governor have been talking about some of the issues they expect to debate in the coming months. With me to talk about all this is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, this will be Governor Hobbs' fourth State of the State speech. So what are you expecting to hear from her this afternoon?
Well, we start off with the obvious, which is I've been your governor 3 years. I've done a great job. The state is in great shape. And the undertone of that is just reelect me. Because I'll be on the ballot. Beyond that, I think she has some issues she'd like to share. The biggest, of course, is money, as always money. It starts off with the question of who gets a tax break. Now, this is fascinating because the fact that this is the same governor whose own economic advisor said last year, we're in for a little bit of deep kimchi this year, and we really should figure out how exactly we're going to deal with that. I think what happened was H.R. 1, the big, beautiful bill, passed. That had a bunch of tax breaks in there. The Republicans said, oh, we like these. We'd like to conform to the same tax breaks, the higher standard deduction, things like that. And the governor said, oh, wait, I've got my middle class tax breaks, and I want to talk to you about those. So I think that'll be a very big issue. She doesn't particularly like the ones for the business, the accelerated depreciation. So that's going to be a big fight. The other part of it becomes, how do we spend the money? Now, we're not going to see her budget until Friday, and she insists it'll be balanced and everything will be fine. But I think she's going to urge folks to invest in certain things. I think we'll look for some more money for a Colorado River litigation fund, should it come to that, because we know that Bureau of Reclamation is waiting on the states to settle the upper and lower basin states.
Yeah.
And then there'll be a lot about her basic philosophy and why she says legislators should pay attention to fiscal issues versus social issues.
Howie, in the past, we've heard the governor talk about education and specifically ESAs, school vouchers. Any expectation that she will be talking about that later today?
I think at the very least, you will see her want to put in, I don't know whether you'd call them guardrails or perhaps some better monitoring. There is a consensus that there have been situations where particularly homeschool parents who are getting these $7,400 checks have used them for less than educational things. I mean, that particular pregnancy test probably doesn't relate to your biology class. The issue of whether she's able to go ahead and rein them in, I mean, she's tried this every year she's been there. I don't know how much she's willing to keep beating her head against the wall on this one, but it's a non-starter. Anything that says we're going to take vouchers away from people who already have them is not going anywhere in this legislature.
Sure. One other education note, Howie. The legislature and the governor need to come up with, or at least the legislature, with an extension of Prop 123, which was narrowly approved by voters. The measure ended last year, but the state filled in the money to make up for it, so the schools didn't lose that money. It seems like that's not really an option this year, but there hasn't been consensus on what to ask the voters to extend. Might we hear what the governor's plan is on that today?
I think you will hear something asking for an extension. Now, remember, there's two issues in here. Number one is how much money to be able to take out of the funds and where they would go. The original Prop 123, which, as you point out, expired, sent it to basic K-12 education. The schools pretty much got to use it the way they wanted. There are a lot of Republicans saying, number one, we want it used for only for teacher salaries. And number two, on the other hand, the governor saying, well, we can actually take out more money because the Education Trust Fund is healthy, and we could also use it for school safety and for non-teacher salaries and such. The other issue is if you're going to put something on the ballot, there are a lot of Republicans say, wait a second, let's put in some constitutional protections for these Empowerment Scholarship accounts, these vouchers here, because they are protected under a Supreme Court ruling. but they could be taken away, not necessarily by a court. I think court would have a hard time saying they're no longer legal, but a future legislature. But if you put them into the Constitution, the only way to get rid of them is by going back to the voters. The governor does not want those issues tied together. Is it critical? Well, the fact is, as you point out, they have done the backfill of the $300 million a year so far. They could keep doing that forever, but it means $300 million less to provide for tax breaks or services. So there is some push on both sides to go ahead and get that done.
So, Howie, you referenced the tax conformity issue, which is expected to be a pretty big issue right off the top. Anything else that you're expecting or that you're looking for sort of in this first several weeks of session to be a big issue?
Well, big is relative. I think there are some areas where they found consensus. I think, for example, the whole issue of data centers. When the data center law was first established in 2013, data centers were placed for cloud storage. You know, I've got 42,000 pictures here of Aunt Martha, and I need to store them somewhere. Now we have AI. Data centers have become bigger, more expensive, which is necessarily good for construction costs, but they also use a lot of water. They're noisy. Some people would say they're ugly. I think there's finally consensus to say, look, we can't stop people from building data centers. What we can do is say, we're not going to give them a tax break to go ahead and build them here. And that was what was put in again in 2013. The governor said it's time to get rid of tax breaks. You have Representative Neil Carter, who already has a bill in to do that beginning at the end of next year. And you've got to, not only some other Republicans who are interested, but Andy Biggs, who could be the governor's Republican opponent in the November election, also says perhaps it's time to get rid of tax breaks. And again, remember that he also voted for them back in 2013.
Mm-hmm. So, Howie, quickly before we let you go, the conventional wisdom is that during an election year, the legislature wants to try to keep its session short so members can go and campaign for reelection or election to something else they're running for, and so that they can collect campaign contributions. Any sense of how long lawmakers might be at the Capitol this year?
Well, as you point out, you know, there's the issue you can't take campaign money from lobbyists during the session. Theoretically, you could raise money somewhere else. You've also got the fact that the primary this year is going to be in July. I mean, this has gone back week after week after week as we try to meet certain deadlines. I think, as you point out, there's pressure to get out of there. I think there are some lawmakers, for example, Warren Peterson, who's a Senate president, who may quit the legislature to be able to run for attorney general full time. So that may not affect him. I'd say the chance of us getting out of here by the second or third week in April, which is theoretically the week of the 100th day, which is what the rules require, not going to happen. I'm guessing more closer to perhaps May 30th, somewhere in there. But again, you never know the kind of things that are going to delay the end of the session. There could be some big problem that nobody realizes. And that's the other rule I've got to warn our listeners about. Every year you ask, what's going to delay the end of the session? And every year it's something that was not on anyone's radar in January.
Right.
When we're talking in June, we'll know.
We'll find out as the time comes. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
Have a great morning.
Protests continued here and around the country over the weekend following the shooting death of Renee Nicole Good, a Minneapolis woman who was shot in her car by an ICE agent last week. The killing has been defended by the Trump administration as self-defense, but local officials in Minneapolis disagree, and tensions are reaching a fever pitch in cities around the country as people take to the streets demanding justice for Good and a stop to ICE raids. And this all comes as news broke recently that ICE plans to target Phoenix next in its mass deportation campaign. Well, our next guest this morning says this escalation was inevitable. ICE has ramped up hiring of new agents in a major way in recent months. The government announced last July they want to hire 10,000 new U.S. enforcement and customs enforcement officers and 3,000 new Border Patrol agents. And they're being hired with the goal of carrying out what the president has called the largest mass deportation campaign of all time. Joe Hyman is professor of anthropology at the University of Texas at El Paso and director of the Center for Inter-American and Border Studies there. He studied ICE and Border Patrol for decades, and I spoke with him more about this shooting death by an ICE officer and asked, is he surprised?
I'm
shocked and deeply concerned, but not surprised. If you send thousands of agents into the field to arrest people, to sort of sweep them out of society, and they're right in the middle of everyday life in the United States, these sorts of things are inevitably going to happen. They're not just individual one-off, you know, bad incidents. They're a systematic pattern. Mm. I mean, the one thing I would say that I think people wouldn't really know is that this kind of stuff has happened off and on, but over time consistently at the U.S.-Mexico border itself. And so the rest of the United States is experiencing what has been a long time pattern at the border.
Okay, so let's talk about why that is, right? You've done extensive research on this on the border and within immigration enforcement for, it sounds like, decades. And, you know, produced a report not too long ago talking about how caution is needed before hiring more Border Patrol and ICE officers. We've seen this massive uptick in hiring from the Trump administration, efforts to hire thousands of new officers. What are your concerns there?
Well, I have a particular concern with not checking their background adequately, making excuses for problematic past histories. You know, people who were police officers, local police officers, but were disciplined, who are trying to move on, for example. You know, everything is going to be swept under the rug in order to meet enormous rapid hiring quotas. And this is not just something that we imagine might happen, because it was what happened in the post 9/11 hiring surge with the creation of Department of Homeland Security and a huge number of people being hired into especially Customs and Border Protection.
Mm, so we've seen this in the past. I mean, that's one level of concern, right? That background checks will not be complete, et cetera. But I mean, I wonder just on another level, just rushing a lot of people into positions like these, which have a lot of power. I mean, are requirements being lessened? It sounds like the amount of training is being lessened. People are getting, you know, incentivized. There's sign up bonuses, high pay, student loan forgiveness, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that the things that are being incentivized are not just the money that they're getting to be hired, but also what the rewards are going to be for the kind of job they're doing. So right now, the rewards are going to be for maximizing arrests, mass enforcement, sweeping people out of the community. There are some kind of a steady number of cases that we're seeing of U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. Being arrested and held. So I think that the incentives are not just the money that people are getting to be hired, right, but also the incentives to be successful at grabbing people out of society.
So this is what you mean when you say you're not surprised this is a systemic problem within this department, these departments. It's about priorities.
It's about priorities. People, you know, in organizations are sensitive to the kinds of messages they get about what is acceptable and tolerable, what is actually rewarded, what is encouraged, how can you move up in the ranks. All of those are messages that you should, you know, cut corners, be aggressive. There are dangerous people who are after us as law enforcement. People in law enforcement do know legitimately that it's a job with some potential danger. I mean, it's by no means the most dangerous job, but they know to be aware that they're dealing with people who might resist or might flee or might be in a dangerous situation. And that can be turned into a kind of an attitude that everybody outside of the organization is dangerous. And I've heard that often from DHS, from Customs and Border Protection, and from ICE. And that is a concerning thing, because those are the cases where people make snap judgments that are dangerous judgments, judgments to shoot or judgments to dangerous pursuits. I don't think people, you know, we're just getting the news about actual shootings, which are the worst. But I think out there for actually in this past year, it's been terrible here in El Paso, dangerous pursuits. So there's a, if you send signals out to people that you're, it's us against the world, and the world is dangerous. And if you send signals out that you need to be as aggressive as possible to make as many arrests as possible, then you're going to shift the balance of all these little subtle decisions and judgments that law enforcement officers do have to make. Right. You're shifting the balance of those towards the higher risk, more dangerous types of decisions.
So I mean, you mentioned having talked to officers who kind of have said that to you, have espoused that point of view. Tell us more about the time you spent in, you know, embedded doing field research, as you would call it, as an anthropologist with ICE agents or with Border Patrol agents. Like, the culture seems to be at play here.
Yeah, I mean, there are diverse organizations, there are diverse individuals and diverse organizations. And right. So one can't simply lay the same thing on everybody in the same way. But these are organizations that have enforced the law against people who are marginalized and voiceless in society. And so they don't have as much experience as local law enforcement does with the kind of checks and balances that are put on by the, you know, being part of local society.
Right.
And local law enforcement has its problems, but really they're kind of a, you know, an imposed force in these communities. And I especially think if we're getting a whole lot of people recruited and put on the streets very rapidly, that's going to worsen that imposed force.
Let me ask you lastly, the Trump administration is not going to stop its deportation campaign anytime soon, it seems. We're, you know, like not getting rid of these agents en masse. Like, is there a way to do this right, to train them the right way? Like, are there examples of that happening when you need to hire a lot of people, you could do it well?
There are examples of improved training, for sure. One of the problems is that they're being pushed through so quickly. Mm-hmm. They're cutting back on the amount of time for training. One of the things that I saw that concerned me a great deal is that they're cutting back on the time for language training, specifically in Spanish. They're using translation software on people's phones, right, which is just not going to be adequate. One of the things that part of that common sense that a senior officer told me, somebody in immigration enforcement said, you know, he said he thought that bad things happened when officers couldn't speak Spanish. And so they were shouting out commands to people who didn't understand what they wanted.
Yeah.
You know, that's not really that difficult, but I think it's all being bypassed. And it's being bypassed because they want to rush people into the organization. It's also being bypassed because the attitude is, why should we be polite to immigrants?
Hmm. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Joe Hyman, professor of anthropology at the University of Texas at El Paso, director of the Center for Inter-American and Border Studies as well. Joe, thank you for coming on. Thank you so much for your perspective and research here. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a team of artists use 3D scanning to document subtle changes in the Sonoran Desert.
But first, it's safe to say that 2026 has come out of the gate hot with seismic upheavals from Venezuela to Minneapolis. So last Friday, we invited Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego to stop by the studio and offer his perspective on some of the year's major storylines thus far, starting with health care. Federal subsidies to help Obamacare subscribers pay their premiums expired on December 31st of last year, and for millions of Americans, costs are about to skyrocket. As Senator Gallego told our co-host Sam Dingman, the implications of that are about to become very real.
At this point, everyday Americans are going to be hurting. And the people that get hurt the most by this are actually a population that tends to be they're not Medicare yet eligible. Right. They tend to have their own job or business. You know, a realtor, for example, is a good example. Their premiums now are probably jumped. You know, we've heard some horrific stories like, you know, 100%, 200%. You know, we've heard of families just saying, like, I'm pretty young. My family's young. Like, I'll just, you know, hopefully just go to the emergency room if it happens. That's not the situation we want people to be in. We want people to have coverage. Now, it doesn't mean that, by the way, that this premiums and the Obamacare is the best thing we could be doing. But what we do need is time to fix this. And we need time to fix this so that we could have a good program and to have lower premiums. Now, that could be a lot of things. We could be dropping the age of Medicare to 60, allowing employers to buy into Medicare for older employees, you know, a lot of things. But the last thing you want to do is pull the rug on people.
Right. So if I'm hearing you right, you see that there are a number of levers of potential compromise.
Absolutely. Like, we are willing as Democrats, you know, we know we're not in charge. So we're willing to compromise. We're willing to negotiate. We're willing to put caps and whatever it takes. But we, as long as at the base level, people are covered, people have insurance, and they're not dropping insurance because of costs. And then let's use that time to negotiate a new plan so that way we don't find ourselves dealing with this every 2 to 3 years.
But let me ask you, Senator, in a lot of the reporting about this, it has been said that one of the key sticking points here is abortion and the question of whether or not restrictions on abortion need to be part of some sort of compromise. Is that on the table for you? Is that on the table for any of your colleagues?
The ACA, when it initially passed, had what's called the Hyde Amendment already on it. And this bill would also have, again, the Hyde Amendment on it. What Republicans are talking about isn't just the normal you cannot use your government subsidy for a elective abortion. What they're saying is that if you take any amount of money from the ACA, you cannot provide abortion services. So this goes beyond the norm, and it's not supported by the public. And so I would not go down that road because it's unnecessary. We've had a very good agreement that has worked when it comes to abortion restrictions using federal funds for the last 15 years. We'll just when it comes to ACA, and we'll continue to use that.
Right. All right. If I could, I would like to ask you about Venezuela. I want to play a clip of what you said in a recent interview about this on MS Now.
But let's be clear. The American public does not want this. The American public does not want another forever war. They want prices to be lower. They want to buy a house. They want to be able to have their kids get a job. Right now, what's happening with this president is he's using everything he can because he can't control the things that people really care about.
So do I hear that right? That you see...
I really hate the sound of my own voice. To be honest, is that normal? Does everyone else hate the sound of their own voice? Okay, good, good, cool.
I have devastating news for you. This interview is being recorded.
Yeah, I know.
Do I hear that right, though, Senator, that you see things like the arrest of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela as a distraction campaign on the part of the president?
Not just a distraction campaign on the part of the president, but it actually is the focus of the president. The president knows that his campaign promises, which were to bring prices down, to make life for everyday Americans a little better, the same thing that I ran on, are not happening because his actions are causing the downturn in the economy. And so in order for him to actually change course, he'd have to admit that he is wrong. So he's not doing that. But where he thinks he sees success is in the international realm. So he's just doubling down on that. Certainly in the best interest of his friends because he's trying to negotiate with oil companies, but it's not certainly in the best interest of this country, and certainly that's not what the voter wants right now. The American people are sick of wars, certainly wars that are going to only benefit oil companies.
And what about the president's argument that through U.S. control of Venezuelan oil reserves, there will be some sort of trickle-down economic benefit to the American people?
Well, right now, gas is as low as it gets, right? The average, you know, barrel right now is below $57. And also the gas that comes out of Venezuela is hard to refine and put
right
into U.S. system. So this is not something that happens overnight. Number two—
And to be clear, that's primarily crude, right?
Crude,
that's coming
correct
out of
yes
Venezuela,
yep,
which is much more difficult to refine. And,
exactly,
yeah, okay,
yes. The other thing, it's like, are we listening to ourselves? What country are we becoming— where we're going and using our military to grab oil to bring down the cost of living for Americans. That's not what we do. You have people around the world that are now questioning, you know, American morals about whether or not we're going to back them or who we are backing. That does not help the American people. That does not make us safer and certainly does not make the world safer.
So finally, Senator, speaking of safety, earlier this week, an ICE agent named Jonathan Ross shot and killed an American citizen named Renee Nicole Good in Minneapolis. Since then, we have seen outrage. We have seen questions about the federal government's jurisdiction, both mm-hmm in terms of the ICE raids that led to the shooting and in terms of who should investigate the killing. At the end of last week, the news website The Bulwark reported that Phoenix is likely to be the target of the next round of ICE raids. I think a lot of people here are scared.
Well, this is all designed to scare us. And I think it's a very important for Phoenicians, for Arizonans, to understand that they will, you know, violate people's rights. And we have to make sure that we're here to protect each other. You know, what we saw in Minnesota shows that whether you're undocumented or whether you're a citizen, ICE is rogue. They don't care. You know, if you look at the video, the woman is clearly trying to get out of the situation. The ICE officer puts himself in danger, and you know, from what I understand, he has training. But you know, talking to people that have been involved in law enforcement that actually are trained by ICE, and someone like me who actually had to do vehicle inspections and stops in Iraq, you never purposely put yourself in the front of a vehicle. And the fact that he didn't cease to stop shooting even after the vehicle kept going tells you that this person, it should not be an ICE agent. This needs to be investigated. And in general, the reason we're finding ourselves in this situation is because ICE is being used incorrectly. If you want to do this in a professional manner, you get warrants, you target criminals, you work in a manner that does not create the community to be your enemy.
I'm glad you brought this up, Senator, because I wanted to ask, you were, of course, a co-sponsor of the Laken Riley Act, which expanded ICE's authority. That bill passed almost exactly a year ago. Given what we've seen over the last year, culminating in the killing of Renee Nicole Good, do you still support ICE's mission? Do you think they can still operate with credibility in American cities?
I think ICE has to be reformed. You know, we can all pass laws that are designed to go after criminals, and that's what, you know, Laken Riley was designed to do. But if you have an abusive law enforcement force that's being essentially covered by Stephen Miller and the president, where they feel that they have no accountability, this is what we're at. And by the way, we need to move towards immigration reform.
Are you having any conversations with your colleagues across the aisle
Yes.
that indicate that that might be something that could happen under a Trump administration?
I've been having conversations with Republican senators regarding this. The problem is this administration doesn't know which way to go. You have the Stephen Miller, kind of J.D. Vance sector of the White House who just believe that all immigration is bad, even legal immigration. And then there are some people within the White House because they're getting pressure from hotel owners, from farms, from everything else like that, from business community that, you know, they don't have the labor workforce to do that. But there's lots of ways to compromise where we can have safety and we could have, you know, good, sane legislation that allows families to stay together while getting rid of the criminals that exist in this country.
All right. I've been speaking with Senator Ruben Gallego. Senator, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. President Trump announced recently he wants to do something that Democrats here in Arizona have championed before, bar Wall Street investors from buying single-family homes. For years, these big firms have bought up homes and then often rented them out, and critics say it's driven up prices, a trend we've definitely seen here in the Valley in recent years as prices have gone up. Today, it's harder than ever for first-time homebuyers to break into the market and buy a home, and I'm joined in studio now by real estate analyst Tina Tambor with the Cromford Report to find out if this proposal could make it easier. Good morning, Tina.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's start with the impact of so-called Wall Street investors on the Phoenix housing market here in Metro Phoenix. Like at one point, it sounded like they were buying up quite a few homes in the Valley. What's it looked like?
Well, they were for a while when we were going through what I like to call our crack cocaine season of 2021.
Oh, man.
It was really crazy when the rates were very low and we were starting to see the prices rise. We saw a lot of Wall Street type investors coming in and buying a lot of that. We got as high as maybe 10% of our sales were going to institutions, which is pretty high. But the long-term trend for institutional ownership is extremely low. Like the current rates now are less than 0.1% of anything being purchased by an institution. They did take some heavy losses over the last couple of years.
Right.
And so even our rents have been coming down because they bought up the homes and they turned them into rentals. That increases the rental supply, drops rents. So there's all kinds of ways that they can create a rush and then a pretty terrible hangover.
So it has been a reason prices have gone up here, but it maybe is not a huge reason right now.
Yeah, they're not all buying and renting them out. You have institutions like Open Door and OfferPad that buy them and flip them to another buyer. And so, of course, all we have to go on is a tweet, so we don't really have the details of, you know, what type of institutional ownership is this going to cover.
Right.
But or if it's even going to go any farther than a tweet, a test of the market, a test of us analysts to come out and, you know, pull up more charts and graphs and things like that. But overall, the institutions have had an impact, a short-term impact. But right now, they're all pretty dormant, all Open Door, OfferPad, the big buyers, Invitation Homes. They're pretty dormant on the acquisition side.
All right. Do you think then a proposal like this could make a dent as we're watching housing prices, you know, much higher than they used to be? First-time homebuyers having a real hard time getting into the market. Would this be a solution in any way?
Not in our current state. I'd say since most of the institutions have already pulled back, we're not seeing anything that would impact us here short term. But it could potentially lessen a future wave of demand, lessen the impact of institutions if they pass it.
So tell us, Tina, like what has caused home prices here to go up so much in the last several years?
Well,
a lot of things.
it's kind of a big bag. But I would say that when we had very, very low mortgage rates and our incomes have been rising here in Greater Phoenix, and so that created a big wave of people who realized that they could then afford a home. And so what that does is it kind of attracts everybody into that marketplace, and it attracted a lot of cash. And that is what pushed us up in 2021. We peaked in price in June of 2022, and we're down about 14-15% from that peak.
Yeah.
We've been pretty flat in our pricing. The good news is for those first-time home buyers, those rates coming down, every 1% drop in the rate is a 10% drop in your mortgage payment, principal and interest. And so we were at 7.25 last year. We are now at about 6.1. Always talk to your local lender, by the way. That's where we are nationally. That is a full. That's more than 10% off, and we're also seeing in that 300,000 to 400,000 range that our prices have come down about 3 or 4 extra percent from that. That drops you again. So I'd say with all of the incentives going out, the buyers who maybe felt frustrated over the last couple of years should probably recheck their options.
Interesting. Okay, so now might be more of a buyer's market. It's been tough on sellers though.
Yes. It has been very tough on sellers because with very little appreciation, they may or may not have the equity. The longer this has gone, we are now looking at, you know, maybe a good 4 years of very little appreciation, if any, even some depreciation on homes. And so that means that the sellers have less to work with in terms of incentives for the buyers, in terms of the, you know, price reductions and things like that. They're having to look at other options, but they're not desperate. So if they don't want to deal with this market, they just don't put their home on the market. And that definitely helps keep our supply from rising and creating another problem like what we had years ago.
The other kind of problem.
Yes.
Let me ask you lastly, then last minute here or so, Tina, looking toward the new year here at the beginning of 2026, it looks like this might be a relatively balanced market. What are your projections? What are you looking at?
We're definitely coming out of a buyer's market. We were in a buyer's market all last year. We are moving towards a balanced market. And there is a, I would say, a mild sense of optimism in the real estate industry that we will do better this year than we did last year.
Okay.
And that demand right now is not worse. It's right about the same as where it was at this time last year. But we're watching to see how much supply comes on. That really is the factor. We're hoping we'll have a good spring season. Last spring, we had, you know, the tariff announcements came out in the middle of our peak spring season and really put a big dent in that. And we had a kind of a dud of 2025. The bar is very low. I'm just saying the bar is so low that, you know, anything improving onto that will give us some optimism in real estate.
All right. So a little bit of optimism then. Tina Tambor with the Cromford Report joining us. Tina, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Hundreds of protesters in Iran have been killed and many more arrested, according to a human rights group based in the U.S., as protests in that country continue. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. And Rob, this is clearly going to continue to be a big story this week. What is the latest from Iran?
Yes, so the protests in Iran, which have been going on for about 2 weeks now, have been, you know, pretty much front and center. I mean, as you know, there are so many international stories at the moment with the kind of White House in the epicenter. So Venezuela, you know, Cuba, Greenland, there's so many international stories we could be focusing on. But Iran is definitely pretty near the top of that pile. And certainly over the weekend, we were thinking this is going to get even worse. It's going to escalate even further because it has been doing that over the past couple of weeks. And we've seen a lot of people out on the streets now. In years gone by, in 2022 in particular, when a young woman was taken into police custody for she was wearing her hijab, her head covering, but she wasn't wearing it properly. And she was taken in by the morality police. She died in police custody, and that brought thousands out onto the streets in Tehran. Now, these protests have been different because because they brought a much wider variety of people out onto the streets, anti-government protests, anti-corruption, anti the kind of economic situation that afflicts Iran at the moment, which is very severe. There have been lots of people out on the streets, and they've come from all walks of life, and they've come from all over Iran. So all the kind of towns and cities of Iran have seen these protests. Now, what we've seen in the last 24 hours, we've seen Iran's president appealing to young people, interestingly, not to join the protest movement sweeping the country. The president, Masoud Pezeshkian, said his government's violent crackdown will continue. And in an address to the nation, he said his officials were, quote, willing to talk to genuine protesters, but he repeated claims the unrest was being manipulated by Iran's enemies, in brackets, Israel and the U.S. in particular, and led by troublemakers. And that word troublemakers in translation usually means that the security forces in Iran will severely crack down on them. That's what we've seen happen. And there are all sorts of different estimates for how many people have been killed. The BBC and most international media are not able to report inside Iran. We're not given the permission to do that. But we do have a BBC Persian service, and they get a lot of information from their contacts in the country, and that's what they've been saying. So this is still an ongoing situation. I should just say the latest is that the Iranian foreign minister says that state forces, security forces have brought the ongoing demonstrations under, quote, total control. But we should be careful about necessarily believing that, because, of course, that's what Iran would want the world to believe in. And we should also bear in mind that Mr. Trump, President Trump, has said that there may be some sort of ongoing negotiation with Iran, because he, of course, threatened to go after Iran militarily if more peaceful protesters were killed. So it's very much an ongoing situation. We're watching what happens there.
Sure. All right. So, Rob, let's talk now about an interesting court case that will get underway this week in the Netherlands at the UN's top court, the International Court of Justice. The country of Gambia has brought a case alleging genocide against the military government of Myanmar. What's going on here?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. So going back to about 2017, people may remember that Myanmar, which used to be called Burma, that country, the army, the armed forces in that country took on a Muslim minority called the Rohingya. And those people who have always felt like second-class citizens in that country and are often regarded in Myanmar as being immigrants from neighboring Bangladesh. So in other words, people don't necessarily see them as belonging to Myanmar, and they're often persecuted in this way and have been for some time. Now, the army really attacked them in force, and a huge number of Rohingya Muslims fled across into Bangladesh. And if you go to Bangladesh now, you will find refugee camps, huge refugee camps in Bangladesh. These are populated by the Rohingya, this Muslim minority from Myanmar. Now, the Gambia, which is a very small country in West Africa, so why should it get involved in this? Well, it's a Muslim-majority country, and it has the support of lots of other similar countries who want to see something done about this. So they, the Gambia, have led this court case at the International Court of Justice, which is the United Nations top court, alleging genocide against the government, the military junta, if you like, in Myanmar. And this will be a really interesting case. If they are found guilty of genocide, it'll be a case that we look at in terms of how genocide is defined in international law. So it could be a landmark case, and we'll be keeping a sharp eye on that this week.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. Rob, finally, the leader of Canada, the prime minister, will be visiting China this coming week. Why is Canada trying to develop warmer relations with China at the moment?
Well, this is interesting. Actually, China and Canada have been locked in a trade dispute since 2024, the year before last, that was really quite severe. So they've actually had quite a sort of frosty relationship in recent times, each of them imposing tariffs on each other's products and so on. And then what came along was Donald Trump, President Trump's tariffs on many, many countries around the world, as you know, but including Canada. And that was a big problem for Canada, because their number one export market is, of course, south of the border, is the United States. So when these big tariffs were imposed on their products, this was a major shock to the Canadian economy. And it's what's happened. The upshot of that, in part, is that Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada, Canada is now openly saying he's looking for other markets around the world for Canada's exports. And when he met the Chinese leader Xi Jinping on the sidelines of a conference at the back end of last year, they agreed that they would meet. And that's why Mark Carney, Prime Minister of Canada, is heading to China this week to meet with the leadership and to establish a new trading relationship between Canada and China. So this is interesting for its own sake, but it's also interesting because it's clearly an echo, if you like, of the impact that those U.S. tariffs have had on various countries around the world.
Yeah, we'll have to see what comes of those conversations. All right, that is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. Rob, great as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Yes, thanks so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger.
An exhibit at Desert Botanical Garden invites visitors to take a new look at their surroundings.
What Scanlab has done with this show has allowed us a new way to see the desert.
Elaine McGinn is Chief Experience Officer at DBG, and she's talking about the work done by the London-based studio Scanlab called Desert Pulse. It was a two-year process to put together and involved sensors and other technology at around 20 locations, both inside the garden and elsewhere around the valley. Those devices took readings every day for a year. The results show up on screens throughout the garden, complete with an original soundtrack. The images look a little like time-lapse videos and show changes that can be easy to miss in real time. Some can happen overnight, while others can take a year or longer. Plants blooming and then withering, cacti expanding after a rain, homes being built, Chase Field filling up and then emptying out after a D-backs game. Matt Shaw is Scanlab's co-founder and creative director.
Desert Pulse is a portrait of a place over time. It's kind of our studio's homage in a way to Phoenix and to the Sonoran Desert. And I think it offers audiences an entirely new way to see that landscape evolve over time, to see the way that the landscape shifts due to natural causes, but also due to the way that we as humans are influencing.
Shaw says Scanlab has been doing this kind of work for a few years, but never in a place like the Sonoran Desert. So that meant he and his team had some learning to do. He says they were looking for a series of locations where they could really see natural change occur, like how the flora of the desert, including cacti, change over time, spaces where the presence or lack of water was influencing change, and spaces where humans are directly influencing the environment. Shaw says coming from the UK, the word desert meant a few things to him. But he says Phoenix and the Sonoran Desert have proven almost all of them totally wrong.
I think the biggest thing that I take away is just how filled with life the natural world is there, you know. The way that cacti have evolved and the way that cacti shift over the course of a year to deal with the conditions in which they are growing is just absolutely incredible. And, you know, yeah, that overwhelming teeming with life aspect of the desert was something I was just not expecting at all.
And I would imagine that the way that you are capturing the desert, like that's just such an interesting way to think about it because, you know, you come here and you can take some photos or take some video and that certainly, you know, does some justice to it. But I would think that it's just a totally new visual representation of it when you're documenting it, as you say, every day for a full year.
Yeah, and we work with this very special technology. So 3D scanning, and in particular, a form of 3D scanning called LiDAR scanning. And this is the technology that enables driverless vehicles to see the world around mm-hmm. them. It's a technology that everybody is starting to have on their mobile phones as well. It's really, at least from our studio's perspective, the future of photography. You know, photography is no longer a 2D thing. It's a 3D thing. It's a 4D thing when you think of kind of three-dimensional movies as well. So Desert Pulse uses the very, very cutting edge of that technology to document these landscapes in a way that they've never been documented before and to document them with this level of precision and this level of intensity that, you know, is totally kind of groundbreaking science as well as a groundbreaking piece of artwork, hopefully.
That 3 and 4D tech Shaw mentioned, he says that helps viewers walk through these landscapes in a way that's just not possible to do otherwise. Each scan is made up of millions of precise data points. Shaw hopes that's revelatory for the scientists who study the desert and its plants. It offers a different perspective for scientists who walk past a cactus every day to be able to watch it over the course of a year all at once. DBG's Elaine McGinn calls that one of the beauties of the project.
That data will be available to our scientists for years to come. Some of it they don't know yet. I mean, they may have a question 10 years down the road and they, oh, wait, we have something that could show us that. The footage taken of the fire in North Scottsdale is a great example. Watching that over the course of a year come back to life and regenerate, they'll be able to utilize that moving forward. Also, the saguaro site that one of our botanists uses to monitor the growth of cacti. Already, we have seen some pretty interesting data there where some of the saguaros are growing faster than others, and we don't know why.
McGinn says that data will also be made available to any scientist doing research on desert plants. But beyond the scientific information, she believes Desert Pulse will help both residents and visitors see and feel this place a little differently.
So it was important to the ScanLab team to tell the story, not just of the nature, the natural environment, but also the people who live here as well. And not just from the impact that people have on the desert and environment, but also the ways that we also are very resilient and have community. There's one scene from a baseball game, for instance, where the stadium fills up, the game goes on, and it's just kind of that sense of being together in community. But there's also the impact that we are having on the housing site, for example, was right there where Raul Puente, our curator of collections, has one of his research sites where he's monitoring saguaros and their growth. And almost overnight, this housing development in North Scottsdale was going up. So we took advantage of that. So that's a place where, you know, the humans are encroaching upon the environment. Encroaching. Humans and an environment are getting right next to each other in close proximity. So what's that impact, what it looks like?
What surprised you when you first saw the images on these screens?
You know, I've been living with these images for a long time. I was seeing bits and pieces of them. The first thing that surprised me is the dancing cholla, I call it. These plants, I mean, I've been working in the Desert Botanical Garden for 28 years, and I always think, there's not a lot of movement here. There's not a lot of growth that you would see, like, in a forest or in a woodlands area. But to see that these cactus are actually moving throughout the year, they're drooping when it's hot, but they come alive when it's rain. Saguaros, you know, contracting and expanding with water. It has completely changed the way I see the desert.
And no shade on any of the other art shows the garden has hosted over the years. This one, McGinn says, is a little different.
This is the first one where it feels like it's about the plants, and they are the stars. Rather than art sitting among the plants are the stars.
And that is part of the point, says ScanLab's Matt Shaw. He wants viewers to see the desert in a new way, to pause and reflect specifically on the changes happening over all kinds of time spans.
You know, at one end of the spectrum there, we allow people to see the blooming of a cacti, something that might be over just in one night, and many people miss that moment. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you know, we're watching landscapes shift over the course of an entire year, and we're alluding to the way that our landscapes have evolved over the life cycle of a saguaro, you know, 175 years potentially. We're alluding to the way that landscapes have formed over the, you know, the lifespan of a river, like millions and millions of years.
Shaw hopes those perspectives will allow viewers to think about the Sonoran Desert differently, its past, present, and future. Desert Pulse will be on display at Desert Botanical Garden through mid-May.
And that's it for this Monday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow with much more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman.